guess so. Want me to put this so it's not in your way?
Okay. Did you just use this mic?
I didn't use a mic. I don't.
Yeah.
I talk loud.
Okay, good. So it's up and ticking, huh?
It is.
Good.
So don't say anything bad about Lincoln,
Lincoln, Nebraska. It is the greatest town in America. Okay.
Get you set up. You just put this about 6 inches from your mouth. Put it on hold, so if you actually hit a button, it's not going to turn off. It's recording now, so you're good to go.
Okay.
You can stick it in your pocket.
Just don't say anything bad right now.
Yeah, exactly. Don't go to the restroom and forget that it's on. That's happened before, so.
I know it.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, thank you.
No problem. Maybe I'll make a loud noise.
Yeah, make a very loud noise.
Hey, guys, I have a handout. If anybody didn't get one, let me know. Everybody got one? There, that kind of quieted it down.
That's impressive.
I'm a teacher. High school.
That's right. You know how to do that.
Here's the rest. I think that I might have put one.
Okay.
I can get one for you, John.
John didn't give him a sign.
Okay. Yeah. Can you guys still see okay if we cut down the lights okay and after the money changers and the temple finish their work? No, that I think that's good. I think that should be seeable. Well, we'll go ahead and get started. This is a session, as John said, a couple of years ago before I literally had a change of heart, and unfortunately it's changed again for the better. I was going to do a presentation on bioethics. That's one of the areas I teach in at Lincoln Seminary, and I am not going to do the presentation I was going to do in 2013, but actually walk you into something I did fairly recently for a seniors, Christian seniors group. They asked me to speak about, engaging seniors in a culture of death. And this is going to actually focus on the side of bioethics oftentimes not talked about. You know, we think in terms generally of abortion or beginning of life type of issues, maybe euthanasia. We have a growing seniors population. Hey, yeah, if you want a cheap cup at McDonald's, you just come with me. What does that mean in our society? Because there is a growing attitude that seniors are starting to bend the economy of our as us baby boomers are growing older. That's causing quite a bit of economic stress. So I want to look at, and this will give you a basic introduction into bioethics, and then I'm actually going to kind of focus at the end on things like hospice are developing. A number of years ago, Pope John Paul II wrote in his Evangelium Vitae these words: "This situation, with its lights and shadows, ought to make us all fully aware that we are facing an enormous clash between good and evil, death and life, the culture of death," he was the one that kind of coined that phrase, "and the culture of life. We find ourselves not only faced with, but necessarily in the midst of this conflict." And so the Pope at that time was looking at Western culture that seemed to be more preoccupied with death than it was about promoting life. He goes on to say, "It is possible to speak in a sense of a war of the powerful against the weak. A life that would require greater acceptance, love, and care is considered useless or held to be an intolerable burden, and is therefore rejected in one way or another. A person who, because of illness, handicap, or more simply, just by existing, compromises the well-being or lifestyle of those who are more favored, tends to be looked upon as an enemy to be resisted or eliminated." Very profound words. More recently, in November of 2014, you remember this young lady was on CNN, in the last session we were talking a little bit about the use of social media, just flying through social media. It almost made me get up in a pulpit and call upon Christians to get off of Facebook, because it was one of the most unhealthy discussions that went on. Brittany Maynard, of course, was this terminally ill young lady, almost 30 years old, who said she was going to take her own life. And she did. And, of course, then you have the Christian community weighing in on Facebook. How could she do this? This awful person. Well, I understand that. But that's probably not pastorally the best way to handle things. But here is a quotation from a CNN interview. She said, "I would not tell anyone else that he or she should choose death with dignity," and kind of pick up on that phrase. I've highlighted it for a purpose, because that's become one of the catch phrases of our culture: death with dignity. "The question is, who has the right to tell me that I don't deserve this choice? Why should anyone have the right to make that choice for me?" That statement, you could do a whole college semester on worldview analysis, because it's just shot full of all kinds of assumptions. What Pope John Paul feared in 1995, Brittany Maynard has embraced, or did embrace. And here's the question that's being asked in our culture: is it our right to die? Now, the answer from contemporary bioethics. What do we mean by bioethics? One of the most helpful definitions I've seen of the term comes from John Kilner and Ben Mitchell, who are two Christian bioethicists, one at Trinity, the other at Union University in Tennessee. And they have defined it this way: bioethics is the process of, quote, distinguishing between what we should pursue and what we shouldn't pursue in matters of life and health. Because as you well know, in the last 25 to 30 years, we have developed things scientifically and medically that years ago people would have died. In fact, I look at my own situation. If I was not living in this era, even 10 to 15 years ago, I would not have survived my heart problems. And actually, cardiology is at a place now that is really, if you can intercept these things in time, it can do some very wonderful things for you. The other side of it is as we create new medicines and therapies to address things, there are always, well, we talk about side effects, and there are always then new questions being raised. In fact, it's a very humbling thing, actually, to realize that in our cures or remedies, we oftentimes create new problems. And it kind of, I have often, when I've lectured on bioethics, taken us back to the Tower of Babel, where if you wanted a paradigm of technological pride, that's it. We will build a tower so high we shall reach heaven. You know, and we haven't learned our lesson since that somehow, you know, we can, create this perfect universe. And then, of course, you need to read Genesis 11 or reread it again, because it's one of the most hilarious chapters of the Bible, where the triune God says, well, let's go down and see what these guys are making. It really is pretty funny. In bioethics today, the governing kind of rule of thought is what's called the Georgetown mantra. It's called that because it was developed at Georgetown University, which is a very reputable Roman Catholic institution. If you talk to any bioethicists or any really people involved in care, there are these four principles: autonomy, respecting the decision-making capacities of autonomous persons, and I'm quoting from kind of the Bible of bioethics, Beecham and Childress, principles of bioethics. Secondly, beneficence, providing benefits and balancing benefits against risks and costs. Non-maleficence, avoiding the causation of harm. And justice, distributing benefits, risks, and costs fairly. Now, yesterday you heard me talk about common ground and how the early church embraced things like the Hippocratic Oath. And you look at these principles, for the most part, they're not bad. Now, probably the most unnerving one for a Christian initially is the idea of autonomy, because God has created us to live in a community, and autonomy is a very Western, American kind of idea. But, you know, beneficence, is this going to provide more help than harm? That's good. Avoiding the causation of harm, that's good. You know, you get into situations today, and dear lady in my church, who I just called on the other day, she is turning 80 years old. They have found a fast-growing tumor in her brain. She's going to have a biopsy this week. If it looks like it is just moving very quickly, she's not going to have surgery. And as a Christian, she's at peace with that. You know, that's not the final enemy. If she could have surgery, but then the results, the consequences of post-op are going to be more miserable than the tumor itself. So that's not bad. Non-maleficence, justice, those are all things we can kind of resonate with. But here's, of course, the complexity of it. We're living in a world of multiple worldviews. So who's giving the interpretation to these things? These four principles seem fairly positive until one realizes that ethical relativism generally governs our society. And so, in a sense, who can define life and death? It could be John Paul, if you want, or it could be Brittany Maynard. We live in a world where, you know, either option, or maybe other options, are okay. In our Western society today, the governing worldview in healthcare is clearly secularism. And, you know, being the respectful person I am, and I, you know, John Oakes does this and as well, let the secularists define themselves. And let, you know, let's be fair. Secularism is a principle that involves two basic propositions. The first is the strict separation of the state from religious institutions. The second is that people of different religions and beliefs are equal before the law. I don't necessarily have problems with the second, but the first, for someone who's committed to a Christian worldview, that's rather problematic, that you have this strict separation. And yet, my friends, as you read this, many Americans would say, yeah, that's a no-brainer. You know, separation of church and state, what does that mean? What it means, if you kind of map it out, is not that atheism rules, but rather we live in the secular, non-spiritual public reality. And spiritual reality is a private affair. You know, you can pray, you can go to Bible study, you can go to church all you want, but don't bring that into the public arena. That's your private views. And secular reality is the common world that we all live in. Secularism is also supported by several what we might term hidden worldviews. You want a good read on worldviews? There's a book that Rich and I have both used, and I use quite a bit with both grads and undergrads, called Hidden Worldviews. I'll show it in just a second, by a couple of guys from Azusa Pacific University. And what they call attention to the fact is most people in our world are not hooked to the formal theoretical worldviews, pantheism, deism, existentialism, but they're connected to what they see in contemporary culture, that is, pop forms of these kinds of things. One being individualism is, and you saw that, remember the Brittany Maynard statement, I am the center of the universe. I am the primary reality in the universe. Now, this is putting it very crassly, but, you know, let's face it, isn't that where people function? My end justifies my means. I am my own moral conscience. Freedom and fulfillment are my right. Performance defines our value. So you go back to the Brittany Maynard statement, and you can see how chock full of her statement this individualistic hidden worldview is. Moral relativism. Moral beliefs cannot be directly observed or measured scientifically, and therefore are matters of personal and or community opinion. No one opinion. Isn't that a popular word in our culture? That's just your opinion. Should be seen as more right than one another. So in a sense, you can go up with John Paul if you want and his view, or Brittany is fine too. Who are you to judge? Scientific naturalism. Scientific naturalism or materialism holds that all that exists is physical and can be reduced to its elemental material composition, which John Bakes is talking about right now. If nothing exists except the material, there are no non-physical realities, such as God or souls. Again, all of these things are kind of subtly feeding into this secular worldview. And pragmatism, America's one philosophic contribution to the world. Historically, it's true. We borrow Europe, and then we kind of you know, high-tech them. But pragmatism we can own. And that's the philosophic movement that includes those who claim that an ideology or proposition is true if it works satisfactorily. That the meaning of the proposition is to be found in the practical consequences of accepting it, and that unpractical ideas are to be rejected. And to put it very simply, it's true if it works. And there's a lot of things that work in this world, but might be a bit objectionable to a Christian. Secularism also fosters then a predominant ethical system, which is called utilitarianism. So if nothing else, you build your vocabulary today, and you can go home and people say, what did you learn? I learned about utilitarianism. What does it mean? I don't care, but it sounds pretty impressive. But I'll give you a definition. Utilitarianism is the ethical approach that identifies the right decision as that which will produce the greatest utility or good for the greatest number of people under the circumstances. That doesn't sound bad, you know, for the community good, but the question is, who's making that determination? And what worldview or worldviews are informing that? Here's a utilitarian perspective on aging and death. Notice again the name of the article that appeared in the Atlantic in October 24, 2014, Why I Hope to Die at 75, by Ezekiel Emanuel. Anybody know who that guy is? In Illinois, we know who his brother is. He's the mayor of Chicago. And Zeke Emanuel was one of the major architects of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. He has now got an endowed chair at the University of Pennsylvania in bioethics. But here's what he said. Here is a simple truth that many of us seem to resist. Living too long is also a loss. It renders many of us, if not disabled, then faltering and declining. And I don't want to hear anybody amening that. A state that may not be worse than death, but it is nonetheless deprived. It robs us of our creativity and ability to work, society, and the world. It transforms how people experience us, relate to us, and most important, remember us. We are no longer remembered as vibrant and engaged, but as feeble, ineffectual, even pathetic. Rich, do you want your grandchildren to remember you that way? In my case, they have no choice. That's essentially what he's saying. When you get around 75 years old, I mean, you start to have illnesses and you forget things. And of course, in his academic society that he runs in, people generally aren't publishing their best papers and books at that time. So, you know, why do you really want to go on? Now, what's interesting, the article, as you can imagine, he puts a caveat in there. And he's about 59 years old. And so he says, when I am 75, this does not commit my children killing me. I can be reevaluated at that time as to whether I am still functioning well. By the way, this guy does oppose euthanasia. He does not promote active killing like with Brittany Maynard. But on the other hand, is simply saying at this kind of arbitrary age, why do you want to go on living, and why should we invest resources? As you know, in healthcare, the majority of our resources and dollars do go to the aging population. And so this gives you an example of what utilitarian. Perhaps the most consummate John knows who this guy is, Peter Singer. Both Johns know who this guy is. He's kind of the consummate utilitarian. He's actually pretty consistent with it, which is the scary thing. Fortunately, again, as we talk about worldviews, praise God, most of these guys are not consistent with the consequences of their worldview. But this guy comes close. He's an Australian bioethicist, currently the DeCant Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University. And he has made quite a... He originally was known for his animal rights advocacy. But here's just a few of the fine Peter Singer quotes that are out there in a, as far back as 1999 in Psychology Today interview. He said, I am not comfortable with any invasive research on chimps. And I think as Christians concerned about stewardship of creation, that's okay. And I think there are other ways. I would say, what about getting the consent of relatives of people in vegetative states? He goes on and says, you have to ask yourself, does a baby have a right to life as it is born? Or does it come into existence gradually? Of course it's gradual. By the way, I tell you, this guy believes that abortion it should be legal up until about 18 months after birth. Because, you know, he basically reasons, you know, what's this little child? This little child can't exist on its own. It's going to make some pretty dumb decisions. And it's really not a functioning, you know, you look at the animal world at 18 months, they're doing pretty well. And so, you know, a child of that age is, you know, he basically subscribes to infanticide. Another one, I'm consistently choosing to spend thousands of dollars on his aged mother. Here's where the rubber hits the road, when you start to bring in family members. And his mother had Alzheimer's, and she was in a nursing home, and he was spending, not surprisingly, thousands of dollars. Here's what he writes. Suppose, however, that it was crystal clear that the money could do more good elsewhere, then I would be wrong in spending it on my mother. If my money could do more good if donated to an organization that helps people in much greater need than we are, I freely admit to not doing all that I should. But I could do it. Now, his mother did die. With him funding her care. But that last comment is chilling, isn't it? I could do it. Because after all, if I could spend it for a more, progressive type of things, why not do it? Is this ethical theory then justifiable? We go back to the Georgetown mantra. Does the Georgetown mantra accommodate a Peter Singer? Well, ask one of the constructors of the mantra, Tom Beechup himself, who is a PhD in philosophy. Many human beings lack properties of personhood. Oh, that's interesting. Or are less than full persons. They are therefore thereby rendered equal or inferior in moral standing to non-humans. Now, this is being written in the 21st century, my friends. If this conclusion is defensible, we will need to rethink our traditional view that these unlucky humans cannot be treated in the ways we treat relevantly similar non-humans. So what Tom Beecham basically was saying is Peter Singer's interpretation of the Georgetown mantra, the four principles of bioethics, are as good as anybody's. Now, he would not be a fan of Peter Singer. Very few people are. Even the most left-wing guys don't like Singer. But nonetheless, what he's basically saying is the worldview behind my bioethical theory certainly accommodates this kind of thinking. Let me just swing to a little bit of the other side, the transhumanists. Who believe that you should do everything to prevent aging and preserve youth and actually technologically defeat death. Transhumanism, what is it? It's an international cultural and intellectual movement with the eventual goal of transforming the human condition by developing and making widely available technologies to greatly enhance human intellectual, physical, and psychological capabilities. Time had a story, this was back a couple of years ago, 2045, the year man becomes immortal. And it was on one of the most noteworthy transhumanists by the name of Ray Kurzweil, who believed that time is coming when we can so develop our cyber technology that we can keep man the computer going. And you should kind of circle this page, because it's probably the first time and only time in my life I quote from Wikipedia. Normally I'll flunk a student for that, but actually it's not a bad definition. So you get my sentiments very quickly. Let me quote a leading transhumanist architect by the name of Nick Bostrom. Bostrom writes that transhumanism does not espouse the suicidal view that we should replace ourselves with whatever more advanced life form we might be able to create. The idea, rather, is that humanity can develop to new levels. Ideally, existing human beings would have the opportunity to continue to grow into post-human beings, in much the same way as infants already grow into adults. Whatever it is we value about humanity should be preserved, cultivated, and expanded. So you get the idea of what transhumanism is we can improve on humanity. So, you know, here's our bioethical world. You got people like Peter Singer saying, you know, we ought to eliminate population that is not strong and viable, and then the transhumanists who are saying we can eliminate death. And
are we getting this from Philip Dick?
Well, you know, it's you're talking about the great science fiction writer, and I imagine there's not one of these guys who hasn't read Philip Dick. They also, by the way, get on TED sometime. People like Bostrom are featured there. And these guys truly believe that we have the technological capabilities of creating the transhuman person. Yes?
Bob, I just want to note that actually the transhumanist group has a candidate running for president.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So his position is, if he becomes president, there's going to be huge shifts toward the transhumanist mindset.
You know, the same thing in common is basically human beings are you can experiment on, and in this case we can improve a human being so that they don't have to die. And on the other hand, you know, they can be lab rats as we
GMO people style.
Yeah. Well, you know who this guy is,
yep.
Clive Staples Lewis, and he's always worth a read once in a while, because if you've not read his Abolition of Man. I was surprised how many of my students had read the Narnia. Well, they all had read Narnia. Some had read the Space Trilogy. Almost none of them had read the Abolition of Man, which is still one of his greatest works. And Lewis wrote this, what we call man's power, and he was such a master craftsman. Notice how man is capitalized, and he's writing this in the midst of the Nazi thing. Man's power over nature turns out to be a power exercised by some men over other men with nature as its instrument. Kind of reminds me of the first Jurassic Park movie, where Jeff Blum's character, the scientist, has that little ditty about how God created a dinosaur, and God created man, and then man killed God, and man created the dinosaur, and how nature becomes something that is manipulated and oppressed. For the power of man to make himself what he pleases means, as we have seen, the power of some men to make other men what they please. And that goes back, you think about utilitarianism. Sounds like it's for the good of society. But in the hands of people who are not Christians, which is largely the majority of those in power, it becomes the power of some men to overpower other men using nature as its means. But the man molders of the new age will be armed with the powers of an omnicompetent state and an irresistible scientific technique. We shall get at last a race of conditioners who can really cut out all posterity in what shape they please. And this was Lewis, again, writing in the context of World War II and seeing what the Nazis were doing with their experimentation on the Jews and the Gypsies and so on. You know, you ramp that up to the 21st century, and you're going, gosh, I think I'm hearing that from Peter Singer and Nick Bostrom and all of these guys. It is kind of interesting, by the way, if you go back and study something like eugenics, and we normally associate that with the Nazis. Historically, the Nazis stole it from the Americans. Because the Americans were experimenting on people who were mentally handicapped, on African Americans, and they were doing it with the approval of many in the leading churches and leading politicians. It's including, and even people like Will Mayo, the founder of the Mayo Clinic. And you're going, that's so barbaric. But wait a minute. When you start listening to these voices from the present that we have just walked into, it's no different. It's just a little smoother and more high tech. So, the question, controllers or creator? The case for a Christian ethic of life. Again, we've talked all conference about a biblical worldview, and Rich, again, has probably walked us into the most rich definition of worldview I think that's out there. But one of the constituent elements of a biblical worldview is its narrative that begins with God and creation in Genesis 1 to Revelation 22, the new creation, God, creation, the fall, and redemption and restoration. And, of course, redemption, as we know in the New Testament, is a two-step. We have Jesus coming announcing the kingdom of God is here and forgiving sin and healing people and raising people. But perfection is still future with the second coming of our Lord. So the Bible gives us a basic narrative of creation, fall, redemption. And oftentimes I invite people to ask, where are we in that play, in that narrative? Where do we find ourselves? Well, we find ourselves in the redemptive, but it's that between first and second where there is still plenty evidence of fallenness and sin. The biblical worldview also gives us some very important core beliefs about reality. That reality is grounded in the pre-existent, transcendent, immanent, good, personal God. About creation, God creates good, but it's fallen, but it's also redeemable. Humanity, here's a key component, all human beings at any stage of life. Our imago Dei. Think about Singer. You know, you're growing into personhood. That's not what a Christian worldview holds. The human problem, sin, salvation. You guys know all of this stuff. And here's the problem. You know, we all go to doctors and hospitals, and we're all making very delicate medical decisions. In fact, it's estimated that 75% of the baby boomers will have to make a life and death decision about their parents in today's world. Should we continue on this kind of treatment? A Christian worldview, then, I think should shape our understanding of bioethics. And I appreciate John Kilner from Trinity and the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity kind of crafting an idea like this, in which he said, for a Christian, number one, our understanding of humanity and life and medicine starts with God. That seems to be kind of a no-brainer. But again, go back to the Brittany Maynard statement. It starts with me. And that's so much a part of our American heritage. It's about me and my rights and my desires. So we start with God. What does God say about human law? It is reality-bounded. God has created a universe that is finite. Now, as any scientist can tell you, we're finding out all the time how big this finite universe is and how complex. I mentioned Francis Collins the other day. But it does have boundaries.
go back to the Tower of Babel. You can't build a tower that is going to transcend the boundaries of creation. Go to Nick Bostrom. Can you really create humanity that won't die? Is that possible? So there are some boundaries. And again, we have found when you start tinkering with some of these boundaries, you can get some atrocious results. There are still people alive who were Nazi experiments. And you can do things to human beings that are ultimately destructive. There are boundaries. And death is one of them. That's a reality. Until Jesus comes again, we will all die. That isn't the worst news for Christians, though. A third thing he says as we read the biblical narrative, we think about Christian core values, is a Christian bioethic is impelled by agape. What is agape? It is selfless, sacrificial love. In other words, I care for people not to build up my resume and my notoriety, but I give to hurting people as God did so in Christ. And so I kind of, you know, drawn it this way. We have, you start with the triune God, who, by the way, again, I have this arrow connected to reality. We have a God who's not a deist God, creates the world and steps away. This world is sustained by this God, who reveals himself in special revelation, in the Bible, in general revelation. We have reality that is bounded by birth and death, and it is served by people moved by the values of the cross and agape. An incarnational demonstration of a Christian bioethic. I'll not read this for you. It's a rather lengthy chapter, but John 11, to me, is very intriguing. Notice the words, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Seems to be a rather harmless statement. But when we think about agape, God's love, that's a powerful motivating factor. One thing that's going to tell you is Jesus is not going to do a miracle just to bring glory to himself. He reaches out to truly hurting people. Now, by the way, yes, God should be glorified, but Jesus' motives are not impure. I'm not going to put on a power display to up my resume. It's because there are truly hurting people. Let me just kind of analyze it this way, bioethically exegete it, if you might, please. As you read that story, notice that it is God-centered. The triune God revealed in Jesus Christ is the starting place in our theory and practice of a Christian ethic, not human autonomy. It is his universe, especially human creation, not ours, and a principle we might derive is early or unnecessary death should be opposed. So, clearly, Lazarus, in Jesus' estimation, has experienced death at an unnecessary and early age. And what that seems to set in motion, so should we. We do not want to see people die in unnecessary early ways. Secondly, it's reality bounded. Death is both opposed and exposed. It is not the final reality. And boy, Christians need to hear this in this world of medicine and transhumanism, that death is not your final opponent. Sin is.
That's right.
And for a Christian, the question is not are you going to die, but are you going to be faithful to Jesus? Death has been exposed as the non-final entity by our Lord. Now, again, we should oppose it where it's an early or a necessary imposition, but we also understand it's not our final foe. It's okay to die. And that will bring me to some of my concluding comments, particularly about hospice.
Christianity. So death is not opposed, is both opposed and exposed. Death is a result of the fall, not of creation. By the way, again, that creation, fall, redemption storyline is so important in addressing a number of questions. I recently wrote a chapter on, I think I alluded to it yesterday, on same-sex marriage. And I'm trying to diffuse a lot of the emotive stuff there. But one thing I was asking theologically is, where does homosexuality and, by extension, same-sex marriage come on the narrative line? Is that creation? Or is that fall? Much like my sin and your sin, I don't think it's creation. And by the way, I did go to that, one of those standard, the standard homosexual bashing passage in Romans that people use. And I said, yeah, but notice the other. Why all these ordinaries think? Oh, because it's one of the whole catalog of evidences that human beings have walked away from the glory of God. So such am I in the eyes of the Creator. Even Lazarus' death, by the way, was temporary, wasn't it? He would physically die again. Death will not be eradicated until the consummation of the world. So here's the point. Yes, Jesus was able to raise people. The early church raised people. But there will not be complete elimination of death until the final. And finally, thirdly, it was love impelled. I go back to verse 6. He loved Mary and Martha. Yes, John?
Yeah, I just want to add a little bit to that.
Yeah.
Because our culture assumes death is evil somehow, and yet in the Christian worldview that makes no sense. And I think one of the greatest ways we can share our faith is through Christian funerals.
Yeah. Well, a year ago, and Rich remembers our dear mentor Jim Strauss at Lincoln, really the father of restoration apologetics for many of us, passed away. I had spent some time with Strauss before he died, and it was very clear he wasn't going to be around. And, of course, he was always teaching to the end. And he cited Romans 12, 1 and 2, be transformed by the renewing, you know, off of your bodies as a signature passage. Yeah, I got that. And then 1 Peter 3:15, the apologist's favorite text, only he emphasized, he said, I used to think it was on, the emphasis was on giving an answer, giving a reason. It's for the hope that you have. And he said, in the Roman Empire, and you guys know this, there was not much hope. Death was a very morbid fear in the ancient world. I mean, the Egyptians have a book of the dead. The Bible doesn't. In fact, we really have kind of an ambiguity about exactly what the interim state looks like. We know that there's resurrection. We know that nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ. There is a bit of ambiguity. 2,000 years of church history attest to that. Why? Because the Bible's not concerned about what happens when you die, but it's how you live for Christ. If you are faithful to Him, you know, nothing can separate that kind of thing. So I made sure when I preached the funeral sermon that the hope got emphasized. Because we are people, you said it, John, in this world, who, you know, we will oppose the needless death of people, but we're not afraid of dying. And again, while we're appalled at what happened in Charleston, and we need to raise our voices about that, one thing I know, those brothers and sisters in the Lord are standing before the throne not separated from His love. So anyway, it's love-impelled, it's genuine, selfless love, not a grandiose vision of power and technological control, which oftentimes guides our practice. It's an ethics of virtue more than duty. You can talk about ethical theories, deontological ethics. This is a virtue. This is character. This is nature. So let me propose quickly a pro-life set of values. Life is, number one, God's gift, not a human right. It's God's gift. It's a stewardship. All human life has dignity from inception to death and, of course, beyond the grave. And therefore, things like you hear from Peter Singer or Tom Beecham and others about, less valuable life, or, you'll hear this occasionally, this phrase, well, this was potential life. What does that mean? It's smaller life, maybe if you're talking about an embryo, but what's it going to be? Think about this even, and the early church, by the way, I did some research on the early church in abortion, how they use the incarnation as a major apologetic against the very prevalent practices of abortion in the Greco-Roman world. God became an embryo. They didn't use that terminology then, but a baby in the womb of a person. The incarnation validates humanness at its very earliest stage. Suffering, pain, and death are realities of this earthly existence. There's that boundedness. Hey, ever since the fall and until Jesus comes again, this is reality. The major enemy of humanity, as we said, is not death, but sin. And dying well has profound spiritual implications. You hear that, again, kind of trendy phrase about the good death or dying well. Well, there is a good death in a truly biblical sense. The Bible presents two key characteristics of the elderly, and again, here's where my presentation then began to take it in the direction of the elderly. The elderly are seen as people of wisdom, yay, and weakness, physical weakness. I can't do the things, obviously, I used to do as a younger person. Physically, and so on. Those are two key characteristics. The Bible charges God's people to care with dignity, and this is so key. How do we treat humanity's most vulnerable people? Not survival of the fittest, but with care and special dignity. And as you go through Scripture, notice children. Compare the and contrast the position of children in a Christian, even a Jewish society, with the neighboring world. Children are to be taken care of. Women. Christianity was the most female enfranchising movement in the history of the universe. The sick, the poor, the elderly, those people that society often deems really dispensable and unimportant. And again, how many times do you see in advertising someone who looks sickly about what is society privilege? The elderly, the dying, are opportunities and privileges to demonstrate the created value of all human life and develop caring human community. And again, there's just a resplendent number of scriptures that bear that out, both Old and New Testament. This idea we are called to care for humanity's most vulnerable people, not despise them. So engaging a culture of death, as Pope John Paul II called it, with life-affirming strategies, let me propose these. Number one, and we kind of talked about this in the forum last night, is I think this becomes a discipleship issue. That we need to first and foremost educate God's people about their own belief. As we've said, and Rich demonstrated yesterday, very few people, number one, read the Bible very seriously or have a biblical, anything like a biblical worldview. And therefore, now again, this is not abstract. We all live in the world of healthcare. Are we making thoughtful, conscious, Christian decisions? Or are we truly separating our lives and going in the secular direction that our society would encourage us to? We need to educate God's people about their own belief, how it challenges the dominant cultural models, and provide biblically sound information on things like advanced directives, hospice, and other related issues. This follows through on just about everything today. People get a majority of their information from social media, from the public news media, and a lot of it is just nothing more than baloney. It's not good information. And then the churches tend to propagate a lot of that stuff. We need to take some leadership and give people accurate information about these things, not the sensationalistic nonsense that often goes on. And that takes time. Again, maybe there's someone in your congregation who could take the lead role, maybe a health professional who could make sure the congregation stays up on what is truly happening. Secondly, community. Engage in concrete expressions of love and care for the aged by fostering positive and communal relationships among patient, family, and caregivers. Here's where I'm kind of challenging the autonomy part of the Georgetown mantra. No, God has created us to live in community, not as autonomous beings. And we need, one of the things I have tried to advocate in bioethics is church leaders working as liaisons between the family and physicians and all parties, so they talk, there people are not making decisions apart from each other. Oftentimes that happens, where everybody gets talked to except the patient, and that should be. And being the facilitator of communication and family relationships. Thirdly, here we get into apologetics. And what is apologetics? It's pre-evangelism, isn't it? It is to articulate and expose the inconsistencies and dehumanizing consequences of non-Christian ethical models in a respectful and charitable manner. And then the fourth thing, we talked about civil disobedience last night, is political reform. Support life-affirming legislation and political action. This is listed last because it is not the key point of engagement, but one that emerges as the result of aforementioned strategies. And here again, I point to something like Wilberforce, that you've got to start affecting a change of heart in the culture. Otherwise, it just becomes political gamesmanship. And even if, again, I remember a number of years ago in California, passed the, what was it, the Prop 8?
Yes.
On marriage?
Yes.
And, wow, that sounds wonderful. It's supporting Christian marriage, doesn't it? But it tended to alienate relationships that had been built over time. I think homosexuality is biblically wrong. No question about that. I think marriage is a male and female. But when you pass legislation like that, you start to preempt conversation and relationships that have been built over years. And now the gay person looks at the evangelical Christian person as, you got some political axe to grind with me, instead of having that relationship where you can talk and converse and talk about how God is working in your life and in your values. So political reform, there's a place for it. But unfortunately, Christians have started to place too much trust in this kind of thing, that it's got to happen through Congress or through the state or through the courts. And that's kind of a last thing. One last thing in departing from this. I, with this group, looked at hospice. And hospice, of course, is dedicated. Now, by the way, not all hospice is equal. But hospice is actually a product of a Christian worldview. There was an English woman by the name of Dame Cicely Saunders, who was a devout Anglican nurse who worked in a London hospital during World War II. She befriended a dying Jewish survivor of the Holocaust by the name of David Kosma, a relationship that she says gave her a divine call to care for dying people. It was her epiphany. She went to medical school at age 33, focused her medical practice on helping dying people and alleviating pain, and founded St. Christopher's Hospice in London in 1967. In 1971, it sent a team to establish the first hospice in the U.S. And since 1987, the hospice has been a certified medical specialty in Britain. So here's what a hospice model should look like, I think, reflecting a pro-Christian life view. Of course, life valuing, hospice which neither hastens or delays death, a hospice that practices natural life, natural death, provides foods, fluids, until the patient's body begins to shut down. By the way, this is not abstract. We've had to deal with it, and many of you will too. It provides basic care, including oral care. It provides pain medications in sufficient doses to make the patient comfortable. I think these are all components of a biblically worldview-oriented hospice care, and is within the God-centered, reality-bounded, love-impelled parameters. And I close with a picture of my brother, who, while I was sick, was dying of cancer. He was a preacher. He had, tell you about this guy, he had cared for his wife with Lou Gehrig's disease for 13 years, which is unheard of. He said they had a grieving time when they first heard the words of Lou Gehrig's. Then they prayed and committed themselves to sharing Christ with caregivers. And it was tough. I mean, they had three children who basically only knew of their mom in a bed. He cared for her till the day she died with, of course, help, preached her funeral. What I'll never forget is one of her brothers got up and saluted my brother as an Ephesians 5 husband.
Wow.
It was just tremendous. The next year, their adopted son committed suicide, and he had to deal with that grief. Less than a year later, he had met a wonderful Christian lady. They were going to be married, and he had stage 4 prostate. And he spent the last couple weeks of his life in a Christian hospice center in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. But as we, and I did his funeral, and I was still 3 weeks post-op myself. As I think of his, and this was his funeral text, I preached was Revelation 14, 13. Write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labor, for their deeds will follow. Kind of almost poetically, his funeral was on Labor Day. A reminder of several things. One, of the Christian hospice care that he had been given. That was absolutely wonderful. He had dignity. We talked about 4 or 5 hours before he died on the phone. And life-affirming, and yet death was a reality. There was no escape. And yet it was not the final reality. And the point is, yeah, I don't want to die. I want to see my little grandchildren grow up a bit. But as a Christian, I'm not all obsessed with trying to prevent death. A number of years ago, they told me that I really needed a heart transplant. My students have told me that for a long time. I'm of the age now. I didn't have to go through that. They did some medical corrections and so on. But, you know, there will come a time when that's probably going to be true again. It doesn't get better. I don't want to take a heart away from a 32-year-old mom. You know how you get hearts, unfortunately. Because ultimately, again, we know as Christians, life does not end. at the grave. And human dignity and value are not contingent on your age, your size, your race, your culture, your mental ability. We have that dignity in God. Any quick questions or comments? John, what's our time? How many minutes have
good
I gone over?
I think a good 10 minutes.
Oh, geez. That's a remarkable thing. Any comments or questions? Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it. I wanted to ask, how was it received by this group that you spoke to? Because obviously, they're at that time, friends. They've got to make some decisions. Were there any comments that stood out to you?
Yes, it was largely Christian group. And, you know, they were very affirming of it. Because on the one hand, they get pressures. You get these twin pressures in culture that I mapped out. One saying you're kind of old and worthless, and so you should die. And then the other side saying, you know, you need to keep on being young, and, you know, there's no reason to die. There's something inherently wrong with getting old and aging. And, of course, then our culture saying, if you're not, think about our advertising. You know, and Betty White is a great example of this. Here's a 92-year-old woman acting like a 16-year-old I think there's something fundamentally wrong with that. I don't want 90-year-old people acting like my granddaughter, because I know when she turns 17 or 18, she may transition out of some of these kinds of things. But our culture despises aging, and yet you go back to the biblical material. What does that mean? Yes, we're weaker. But I'll tell you what, and probably anybody in here will say, I wish I would have this wisdom 30 years ago. I wouldn't exchange that for anything, no doubt. Because I said and did a lot of dumb things. Yeah, amen, right? I still do, so maybe I'll live to a 90. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody had a chance to see Kurzweil's documentary called Singularity, where he talked about that. Near the end, he was talking about bringing his father's grave up, taking some DNA, and, you know, rebuilding his dad. And at the end, they asked him, well, do you believe in God? And he paused. He said, well, not yet. Implying that, you know, it's coming with singularity. But anyway, I'm just making a comment. Question that, as it relates sort of a sidetrack to this bioethical question, is particularly in countries like America, where our health care is phenomenal, you know, our fundamental problem is, from a humanist standpoint, everybody wants to live forever, but nobody wants to pay for it. So as it relates to bioethics and some of these other theories out there, you know, how do we, I struggle with this concept. You know, for instance, a couple of years ago, my son and I were playing golf with a guy that we didn't know. They put him with our group. And he'd been in the military, and he had had a really rough life, and he was breathing through a tracheotomy due to esophageal cancer. And he was a veteran, continuously receiving extensive health care benefits, and yet every other hole he was smoking through his tracheotomy. You know, and at some point in time, I mean, we have to wrestle with these issues when it comes to, there's only a limited amount of resources.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, not that we would deny care, but at what point in time we have to make this, you know, a take some kind of stand that says we can't continue to pay for just destructive lifestyles on infinitum. That's a really huge bioethical issue that is coming around the curve. It's not there yet, but we'll begin to make its
well, you know, truth be known, we've been allocating resources, you know, for really forever on things. And, you know, physicians have to make the call that if you're not going to do the things that will manage your life. You know, I look at my own self. I was told, cut down the sodium if you're going to live. Get regular exercise and these kinds of things. Don't have to do that. But then I would say, morally, you know, people shouldn't be spending a lot of resources on me if I'm not going to do things that cooperate with the healing process. There is that point. That doesn't mean, and again, we don't make that decision. By the way, if you look at some of the allocation criteria, some of them are very good. what aren't very good, I usually do a little case study of a 67-year-old poor Latino man in Chicago. It's a real situation. And I ask my students, what are relevant factors here? He's really beyond any kind of heart transplant or anything. But, you know, what kind of things should be factored in? Okay, yeah, he's 67, really old, but he's pretty, his health is really bad. And should he be kept on, you know, some kind of life support system? But what does it really matter that he's a Latino? That he's poor? You know, these things get factored in there too. And that's where I think, you know, getting the justice issue for Christians, we have to take some kind of action of saying, that's not fair. You know, again, we go back to our Imago Dei principle. All human beings, and it doesn't matter what gender or what age or, you know, what kind of mental capacity. By the way, this kind of stuff is going on with the mentally handicapped all the time in our culture. Something like amniocentesis is oftentimes, you know, I don't even want to say encouraged. It's almost enforced on young women. Why? What's the purpose of that? To find out if you're going to have a child that has disabilities. Well, okay, I would say on one hand, that will be helpful information because raising a child with disabilities has its own set of challenges. But, of course, the underlying secular assumptions, you don't want that kid. And, you know, that's where we gotta, let me go back again to the issue of discipleship. Where we've got to start with this stuff is in our churches. And I think John raised that. John, you've been doing this. We've got to get Christians on top of the thing. Instead of, again, we come to church, we have our prayer and Bible study meetings, and then we go out and make secular decisions. And we split these things. We've got to get our people intentionally thinking about what is a Christian bioethic, and it's more than just simply, well, I'm going to elect a pro-life congressman or something. Well, yes, well, you know, people like Reagan campaigned that we're going to promote human life, and it was one of the worst times in America in terms of abortion. Yes?
Well, I want to go to the other side of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now the idea that you can genetically test the embryo to make for sex or genetic diseases, are those embryos that haven't been implanted, do they have to be, what do you do, is that murder if you can, I mean, I'm like,
there's a lot of things,
good. I just say, don't do it, so you don't have to worry about these questions.
You basically stole my sentence.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's very good there, because, again, it's one of these things that has some great matters to it, you know, and I have a heart and feel for it, couples that have wrestled with infertility. But I think what we owe them is to help them parse out the implications of decisions like, what are you going to do with the frozen embryos? And the fact that these things could be very costly, is that good stewardship? They don't tell a woman how hard these would be on her body, these implantations. And then, you know, there's another thing from just the Imago Dei standpoint for me is, are we commodifying life? And again, I'm not, find me a Bible verse. No, I can't, you know, doesn't talk about that specifically, but the theological issues. Are we saying, you know, life is something, well, again, see the new Jurassic Park, even if you get grossed out by dinosaurs. But what the public isn't discussing, you need to discuss in your church, is we can create. In this case, it was a zoo beast
for, you know, people to enjoy. Well, not all that easy with things. You know, when we start commodifying things, and that becomes a concern for me. So I have regularly counseled young couples. Well, I've got to be very honest. We are a family of adoption. I got 14 grandkids. 5 of them are adopted. Not all of them are the same color, for that matter. My wife is adopted. Our oldest daughter is adopted. And that is the direction I encourage couples. If you want to have a baby, in fact, I encourage churches, get behind these young couples. And if they need some financial help in adopting, help them. Hey, you don't have to go to a city of much size. Decatur, Illinois is close to us. A city of less than 100,000 people, and there are babies every day that are being taken away from their biological parents and should be, but are available to raise it. I have two, brother and sister, who wouldn't have stood a chance, you know, growing up in their biological family, and are just wonderful children. It's kind of just a little cute thing. My daughter's had two babies since then. White, and the African-American children are really kind of confused about that, because they had figured that there was a pattern. God would bring out a white one, and then a black one, and then a white one. The sequence is kind of screwed up now in their minds. But yeah, very good point. I think what we need to be raising fundamentally is, are we commodifying human beings? And you know, people can do your test tube baby. I want blue eyes and you know, blonde hair and NFL caliber. Does that come? NFL caliber, you know, arm or something like that. What are we saying about human beings?
Or God's choice.
You know, by the way, if any of you have children or grandchildren with disabilities, one of the most intriguing theologians out there right now is a guy by the name of Amos Young, Y-O-N-G. He is an Asian American. He's a Pentecostal scholar, actually. And in a Pentecostal charismatic environment, for someone saying, hey, these children born with disabilities, that could be a beautiful thing. You know, you don't have to heal them, but rather they begin to heal us. It's just some powerful things. Yeah, someone else had a comment? Yes. Right.
Where do you see the Christian bioethics? Where do you have the problem?
Yeah. With the genome sequencing, there's a very helpful things that we're learning there. But then it becomes kind of dicey when we're going to improve. You know, because again, history ought to show us that when we try to improve on something, yes, we can to a certain extent. What are the possible consequences? Oftentimes, it's impossible to measure. So it's always done, I think, with a bit of caution and humility. The problem is, we get so full of ourselves with our technology that we just want to leap into the next. And again, we have to ask, what is the better person? What is the ideal person? Well, I think Jesus actually qualifies. Well, you know, was Jesus the rock star on a magazine cover? I don't know exactly what he looked like, but if I take Isaiah's description, probably not all that significant. And we got to be very careful of allowing our culture to create, now here is really the ideal person. Because I'll tell you, some of the people who have had the most profound effect on their lives have been men with handicaps. We employ a number in our university cafeteria, and they've been my best friends for 20 years. In fact, I'll share this with you, the deepest honor I've ever received in my life, which was when one of these many mentally handicapped guys died of a heart attack, about 44 years old. and the shelter where they lived called me and said, would you come and do this funeral service? And I, you know, I was asked actually by one of the newspapers, they were, when Steve Jobs died, you know, what would you put on your epitaph? And I said, John's friend. Because there was nothing I could gain out of that relationship or exploit. But he was my friend, and he reached out to me unconditionally. It's powerful. So we got to rethink those. By the way, one more thing about Amos Young. He has really caused me to rethink my idea about the resurrection body. Because again, we have this idea that when we get a resurrected body, and we'll have this perfect, you know, physique. And he said, well, I don't want to push this too far, but think about Jesus' resurrected body. They could tell he was Jesus. Why?
The wounds.
He had the nail prints. He had the spear wound. And he says, you know, maybe our what the world would term disabilities become those things that help define us as human beings. As Paul said, in my weakness, you know, God is glorified. So, you know, maybe I'll be bald in heaven. So what? Hey, thank you very much. And hopefully
thank you very much. Bob, we appreciate it. So we're going to have lunch here. I just want to make a comment on the question. It's when we're trying to amplify or improve on what God already did, I think that's where we get in trouble. Just a little bit about the apologetic. In the early church, Galen said about the church, he said, one thing he noticed is they had no fear of death. And because the Christians had no fear of death, that was one of the reasons that the world took notice. And also notice who invented the hospital. It was Christians. So caring for the sick, the needy, and the hurting, absolutely of those Christian value. Fearing death, definitely not. Anyway, thanks. We're going to have lunch. And remember to kind of try to form up in a group where you can have some kind of a discussion. But we're not going to try to tell you the topic. All right? But we're going to ask people to maybe make one comment about something they learned or discussed in their tables. And that could include the quality of the food if you want. It would be okay. All right, I have to stop this recording.